somebody else wants.
Well, the thing August is, 15th.
It's impossible to ever go back to the old way of life anymore. That's just a, I mean, there's no possible way it could happen. Mainly because there's too many people and too few resources, you know, to take care of them. If all of the natives in Alaska tried to go back to a subsistence way of life, they'd all starve to death. Because there's in the old days, they had very few people compared to what there is now. And they spread out over a big area. Like the Minto people came over here. And see, they covered a big area, and there wasn't very many of them. Maybe about five or six families. And a family would pick up and move wherever they had to go, you know, to catch what they needed to hunt. And they'd have a big hunting area that they'd cover and trapping area. Like old Justin Frank, Richard Frank's father, he had a trap line that went from Minto right across the Sawtooth Mountains down Hess Creek into the Yukon here and back around. And that's where he trapped. And he fished over here in the summer with a wheel and for his dogs and stuff, you know. And those people covered a lot of galdarn territory. And they each had their own area that they went in. And they used to pick up and move. They never stayed in one place. They couldn't. It was impossible to live in one place and survive subsistence. Let's see, like they'd move into a, and they did it all over. You know, like in the Yukon, they had people that scatter out all over the Yukon Flats, way up into Canada, and they'd move down, all come onto the Yukon in the summer. And they had gathering places like White Eye and mouth of Birch Creek, and they'd have a big camp there and put in a big fish trap and catch salmon and live there all summer and take it easy and you know, put up fish and one thing another. And then come fall, they'd pack up their gear, each family, and head out wherever their hunting or trapping grounds were, where they knew they could make a living through the winter, take what they could with them, and then they'd live. That when they moved continually. That's how those caches, you know, in Minto was just a place where everybody gathered in the spring to catch fish. And in the fall, they put in a weir across that creek and the whole village would come there, see. And then they'd catch fish in a cooperative operation and put them away. And if you look at any village in the country, you'll find that they're stopped where they can get fish, because they could always depend on getting fish, where other game would be scarce a lot of times. But they knew they could catch fish, so that's why they stopped in these particular places. And so, you know, but now it's impossible. A lot of them say we'll go back to the subsistence way, but they can't. It's impossible. In the first place, they wouldn't know how to do it. They wouldn't know how to prepare and take care of their food right. And they wouldn't know how to gather it. And, you know, all those ways that they did things are lost except to a few old people that still know how to do it. But they'd never do it again. And it's too much work. It's too hard. It's a hard life. Everybody says it was an easy life, but it ain't. They work from daylight till dark every day. Make a living.
Well, you know, I was thinking about all the food that you catch and gather and put up. It seems like that must be an incredible amount of work that the two of you.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. Yeah.
Houses were either getting food ready to eat or eating it.
But, you know, if you're taking care of your own food, it is a lot of work to get it. You know, because you're not mass producing like they are when your stuff they're selling to the stores, you know.
Have you ever tried to figure out about how much time it would take, say, well, for instance, you were talking about this dried meat that you put up, the jerky. you know, and we didn't get that on tape either. But all that it would take, say, to get 3 pounds of jerky, what's involved in doing that?
Well, it involves probably about 15 pounds of meat, and you have to make a brine and salt it a little bit, and then build a smokehouse and hang it in the smokehouse and keep a fire going for about 4 days, smoking it till it dries out. And it's not that hard, just takes time, you know. The thing that's harder is, you know, you have to cut it all into, you know, strips, so that it's thin strips, so it'll dry good. But like making these salmon strips is what takes a lot of time, the king strip, because you have to dry them for about 3 weeks and keep the smoke going all the time. So you have to cut wood and keep the fire going practically 24 hours a day while you're smoking. And it takes, what do we figure, about 10 pounds of fish to make a pound of strips?
Like a 45 pound fish will be 11 pounds less when you cut the heads and the guts off. And that's not the tail and the skin yet.
Yeah, I think we figured it out. One's about to get about 10% out of a fish from the round in strips.
Now, what about other kinds of food? What other food do you catch and put up?
Well, we catch moose and caribou. And freeze it and you use everything. And then Jeannie cans a lot of it. And we don't buy any commercial meat. Once in a while, we buy pork chops or chicken or something like that. But 95% of our meat we get ourselves through moose, caribou, fish, sheep, ducks, geese, whatever, you know. And then she picks berries a lot. And we puts up a lot of berries, you know, cranberries and blueberries. And then we also she raises a garden in the greenhouse. So, you know, actually we're about as self-sufficient food-wise as we can get nowadays. And still operate, you know.
Well, do you make this moose sausage here, or is that?
Well, that there we had made down in Anchorage. We sent it down, but we make sausage, yeah.
We eat ours all up.
Oh, it sounds like a lot of work. And do you also can meat?
Yeah. Yeah, Jeannie cans whatever we figure we're going to need, you know. And we use it a lot when we go someplace and we don't have to, worry about freezing it or taking care of it.
Now, what's this I heard about sometimes canning on the campfire? Sounds like you've done that too.
Yeah, we did that for quite a few years down here on the beach. We just had the pressure cooker on a campfire to, you know, cook the cans and ran our sealer on the fish cutting table.
One year
until we got this cabin built.
To fish with us, and he came down the river in a barge he bought up in Dawson, and he had the stove on it, and they used it, and then he sold it to us when he left.
Must be weather with batteries. Airplane now. It's Jack. Oh.
Well, talking about, you know, the way you put up food now, what kind of changes has there been in your lifetimes with subsistence and gathering your own food?
Well, the only big problem nowadays is that where you used to be able to just go get what you wanted anytime you wanted it, Nowadays, if you want to go get something, you know, you're afraid all the time that somebody's going to catch you in the wrong place or doing the wrong thing, and you know you're going to get in trouble over it. And you're living in fear all the time, you know. And where you didn't have to do that, you were free. You could go out and have fun while you're doing these things. Nowadays, you don't know when you go hunting if you're in a closed area or in an open area, or if half the time whether the season's open or not, and you read their regulations and you got to study them for a week before you're sure you're, you know, in the right place, and then you're still not sure you're in the right place. So that's the main thing that I don't like about things nowadays is, you don't know what you're doing wrong.
Do you find that sometimes the enforcement officers are just out to get somebody?
Oh yeah, they came here this summer. When they ended the commercial season, we had some nets out and for subsistence. And after they close the season, you have to pull your nets for 24 hours. Then you can put them back in for subsistence, which we did. And we had the nets in, and this fish and game enforcer came along, and he's landing and checking all our nets. And I ran down and caught him in the boat. We saw him land at the one right below here, and asked him what he was doing. And he said, "Well, the season was a closed period." And I says, "No, it isn't a closed period." And he says, "Well, yeah, it is." So I said, "Well, you come on up to the camp and we'll show you where it's not closed in your own regulations." And so we brought him up here and dug the book out, and it says right in there exactly what the season is, and we were right. And he was wrong, see? Well, if the damn fish and game don't even know their own rules and regulations, how do they expect us to know, you know? And, like when you're fishing along here and you pull a net out, you're supposed to have them out at 6 o'clock when the period ends. Or you try to leave them in as long as you can, but you figure out, well, it's going to take me an hour to pull the nets. So you start out at 5 o'clock, so you have them all out at 6. Well, you run into a problem in one of the nets, you know, you get a big drift in it or something. And so you don't have it out by 6 o'clock. Maybe it's 7 or 8. And so you're worried to death in the meantime that while the net's still in, that they're going to come by and confiscate your net, see? And you shouldn't have to live under those kind of pressures. And I know everybody along the river is in the same boat, you know. And finally, people get to the point where they say, "Why in the hell?" And they change things so much. Why in the hell should we live by any of their rules or regulations, you know? They change them. They don't know what they're doing themselves, you know. Why bother with living by them? But if you don't, they take all your stuff away from you, you know, if they catch you. And they're trying to make criminals out of everybody.
So they're going to confiscate your net, you know. What else?
Well, they can fine you. I don't know what all they can do to you, but I know they've confiscated quite a few nets along this river. They get him in after closure, or somebody has some problem with his boat or something and can't pull his net, and they land and pick it up. Then they take it to town and sell it on an auction.
Yeah, sounds like it sure changes things.
And see, before you could go out and fish and catch what you wanted, and you didn't worry about nothing. You know, you're just sitting here fat, dumb, and happy. And now you're uptight and getting ulcers over catching a couple of fish or shooting a moose or something. You know.
Yeah, I have one other question.
We were talking a little bit earlier down by the beach about what kinds of boats you had and kickers and what you started out with. Maybe you could talk about how that's changed. I think you said you started out rowing.
Yeah, originally. But in canoes, you know, we used the canoe to check a net or wheel. But You know, it's progressively got better. The equipment's better and boats are better and motors don't break down anymore.
When you were using a canoe, was that on the Tana River?
Yeah.
Well, what was that like? How far would you have to go on?
We had to paddle from town about 2 miles across the river and down to our camp was. Then we picked a, we had a rowboat where we picked the wheels with and hauled the fish back to the camp. But
so how did you get your fish back from 2 miles down up to Indiana?
Well, we had a motorboat part of the time, but like in the camp, we just had the rowboat, us kids, because we didn't have a motor there.
But those days that you had to go upstream with that rowboat, you couldn't really line there, could you?
Well, part of the time we could, we'd have to go way up before we started crossing, you know, go about half a mile up the river before you cross, otherwise you'd be too far down when you got across. But gave us plenty of exercise. And we didn't go unless we had to.
So now what kind of equipment do you use here?
We got a low-line boat, 18-foot boat with a 35-horsepower Evinrude electric start. So it's real easy to run and take care of. And we have a little lift that we use with an electric motor to pull our weights for our nets, so we don't have to pull them by hand anymore. And we also have a depth finder so we can check the depth of the water so we know where to set the nets without sounding for them. So, you know, it makes things a lot easier. And we need to get easier because I can't handle that heavy work anymore. It's getting to me.
I notice you have a 35, and one of the things I see in a lot of villages, and especially the younger guys, all think they have to have a great big kicker and fast and spend a lot of money.
Yeah, well, they just want to run around to fish. You don't need that kind of stuff. Just something to get from the net or wheel to your camp. And something that'll operate cheap, you know. But yeah, a lot of them have big fancy motors and boats and stuff, but they don't really need them. They just want them. If they can afford them and want them, fine.
How'd you move your wheel around when you didn't have it? At least
we started upstream and we never went back upstream again. We floated it. But we generally knew just to about where we wanted it. And if we had to move it upstream a little bit, it was with difficulty. You know, we'd have to winch it up or use a Spanish windlass or something to get it upstream. We never moved it very far upstream.
How do you get big trees out of it?
Now with chainsaw. Before we used a handsaw. Cut them up.
Cut them up and blow them off piece by piece.
If you couldn't get them loose, you know, any other way.
What did you use for leads early days?
We used, poles. Most of the time we really didn't need leads. Because you caught enough fish anyway, so you didn't need them.
So you mean people just started using leads?
Well, some people used to use them a long time ago, and we used them once in a while if there wasn't many fish coming. But if there's a lot of fish, we never used them because you'd catch all you could handle anyway.
When people did build these, though, they build them in sections, small pieces?
Yeah, and then sink them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about now?
Same thing.
Of course, you don't,
Well, Jack does. He uses them. Same kind of lead.
He sets them all by hand, then?
Yeah.
He doesn't have to use his motor to do it.
Well, another thing I was wondering about, you grew up learning a subsistence lifestyle and how to live in the woods. And I was wondering about Jeannie. I mean, she seems to be right out there with you doing these things and enjoying it. Did she grow up with that?
Well, basically she did. She grew up on a farm in New York, and they lived, you know, pretty much grew everything and, you know, raised meat and vegetables and canned and everything when she was a kid. So she just, you know, fit right into it.
Would you feel like something was really missing from your life if you couldn't go out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
It's probably a pretty hard thing to explain. I mean, just sort of know you'd be missing something, but how can you describe that?
I don't know. Sorry, it's hard.
Yeah.
The thing is that I know that, you know, if things really got tough and there was no more, you couldn't get no more food from someplace, I'd still know how to get food and take care of it and live, you know, and it wouldn't live good maybe, but I could get by.
So you got, it gives you a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I really like to do is walk around a little
bit. With it too. If the moose is not fat enough. But the moose has got the best taste and fat any animal there is. If you can mix, you know, get good white fat. Now we always keep, you know, some of the fat for, like when you're charcoaling steaks, you use that to baste them with. It really gives a good flavor. Just take a piece, you know, a chunk, and just rub it over when it's hot. When you turn the steak over.
Sounds delightful. I asked a guy in Manly the other day, just, I don't know when the season is. Probably go down to 20th down that way, you know, and ask him, when's the season this year? What are the dates? And, well, he had no idea, but he could tell me right now it's too early.
Yeah. Had a movie camera. He wanted me to take pictures, and he was shooting at this moose, and I was up in a tree watching the whole operation with the movie camera. And I get so involved in watching the operation that I hung the camera on the limb and forgot all about it. Never took any pictures. And then I had to go back up. So he says, "Where's my camera?" I said, "Oh God, I left it up in the tree." I was directing him what to do and where to go, and I didn't turn the camera on.
Well, she sure is pretty, you know. And it's, I mean, I can't. Any pictures I were going to turn out real nice. If she just looked that way.
Okay, now it's August 15th and we're still at Al Wright's Fish Camp, and I'm walking around while Kurt's taking photographs.
Oh, you see the grass going right through.
Yeah. Tell how long that's been sitting there.
Kurt just asked how he rigs his net.
People thought all different kinds of ways of doing it. Of course, the shore end. Well, like some people tie their float line onto the shore and leave their lead line float, which is just lay wherever it'll be. And some people tie a yoke like this to their lead line and their float line goes to shore. And now what we do is just let the lead line hang. We tie the float line to the shore and then we just throw it out. You know, right, follow the eddy out, you know, wherever it goes, and then throw our weight over and just tie it to the, we don't have nothing on the lead line.
Mm-hmm.
Just hangs loose. Except on the end we have a loop so it won't get tangled through the net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, made out of a piece of rubber hose. I put a piece of lead line inside the loop so it holds it down, you know, and then it won't go through the holes in the net.
We tried that too. That worked all right. Metal ring. On some of my took a piece of metal ring about that big out of metal, and then it acts as a weight. And this is what we use for weights on the smaller net. We should fill these baskets for it off. On the bigger nets, we just get a couple of great big rocks. Weighs about 250 pounds. Like that one down here, the long net. We run about 300 foot of net.
Like what size rock would you like to use?
Oh God.
Well, we
pull them up. But it would be like maybe about two rocks like that on them. Tie them up with wire and then throw them over. If you get in one of those swirly eddies, it'll pull the anchor. You get, if they're not heavy enough.
That would be all you could lift.
Yeah. But see, we have this little thing that fits in the boat. It's sitting down here by this wheel. I'll show you that. I'll pull you over the side and tighten it up and pull the weight up. Swing it around so you'd set the thing in the boat.
Huh.
And you catch all the heavy pull out of it.
Here,
yeah. Steered way down, runs off of the 12 volt battery that's in the boat. But it works pretty good.
You weld this up?
Yeah.
It's not bad.
So what's the star on this fish room?
This is Brooks. He's building it, yeah.
And where's he getting his guidance from?
Well, Jack has been showing him how to build it.
And who taught Jack?
Well, I helped him a little in Al Woods. Helped him a little on his first wheel. He built a pretty good wheel now. And he's been showing Brooke how to do it.
build a fish wheel when you were 14?
I never built one by myself, no. but I worked on them, yeah.
That's quite an undertaking.
Yeah.
That age.
GI table, so I just took some of the boards and made it out of that.
Ah. That's the first bulk cutting table I've seen
Over
in the Yukon.
Yeah, it's hard to get the old ones. You use that spruce or fir after you cut a few strips and starts making slivers. I've been trying to find some kind of a hardwood that you could cut and wouldn't make any slivers, you know.
Well, when you were a kid, what kind of cutting tables did you use?
Just old board ones, just like about the same as those.
That's the shape you want, huh?
Well, that's good for, filleting. Because you can get through like a big king, you get this knife that's too short and you can't get through it. So we take and have three or four different kind of knives for what we're doing.
What kind of knives do you use for cutting strips?
I use one just like this, or else I have a knife that Jeannie got that's the handle's up on the blade, like up here. About that long. And then you really get some pressure on it, cutting it. So what I do is alter it. I use that for a while and I use one of these and it doesn't get you so tired. You can use different muscles to hold the pressure down on it. And so I can just strip like hell with it. If I get tired of using that, then I can go to the other one for a while. Put a run of mass production. You have one guy heading and gutting, and one guy filleting, and I generally strip. And then Jeannie takes them, grinds them, and hangs them up. That's what we use for our grind things here. And, so we can. Grab two or three strips and a couple chunks of dried meat. That's all I need. You know what? It helps me keep my belly down.
What are these rocks doing up here?
I don't know. Well, Jack does it the same way. They don't dry is good.
Does Jack have dogs?
No, he doesn't have any. He just sells them to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Well, see that shower business up there. That looks pretty interesting.
Well, the way I do it anyways, we fillet them all out and then lay them up like on that long table, all the slabs in a long line, leave them there. You leave them set for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, they firm up better. They're easier and the skin dries. See? So when you throw it on the board and let it, it doesn't slip around. And you can really strip good, cut straight strips. If it's raining, we do, but otherwise just lay them down with the skin side down. They'll dry, you know, enough to where they won't slide around. And then when you flop them on the cutting, the stripping board, then they don't slip when you really cut. But you got to keep it dry and clean, you know. And then if it gets too slimy, you got to take it down and wash it off to where there's no more slime on it. Start over again.
How about when you're cutting the fish?
We clean them right in the river. And then we don't have a bunch of junk laying around for the flies to come around. Throw all the guts and stuff in the bucket and haul them across the river. And the bears and seagulls eat them over there and they don't bother us over here. And we generally, you know, set the other tables up closer to the river. But when we were cutting before, it was way up about here. And so everything's handy. And like when we're just cleaning fish to take them in, that tripod, we just set it right by the river and clean the fish and hang them on the tripod on the scales, and then we slip a plastic bag over them and tie them up and throw them into the boat to throw in the airplane. And we have it all weighed and marked and everything, so when we get to town we don't have to bother about weighing anything, and we know how much we're hauling, you know, so it works out good that way.
You figured out how to streamline the operation.
Well, sort of. And, you know, the camp facilities and everything. How long these caches were rebuilt in about the maybe around 1930, somewhere around that, but they were caches there before then, and they used to just have, you know, platforms for caches, and then they finally got these old slab boards and stuff from sawmills over in the Tanana. And build them up a little better. But this used to be a camp right across here. Well, there used to be a big native camp, and they stayed in the spring. You know, all the people would come here to fish. And that's the reason the caches are there. They put each family had the cache to keep their stuff in or store their fish or whatever. And then they'd come back in the winter by dog and pick up stuff, or if they left here in the spring, they'd leave a lot of stuff here they didn't need in the summer, you know, and they generally came back in here in the fall and caught a bunch of fish. They'd had this weir across the creek and catch whatever fish they needed, and then they'd open it up and let them go, you know.
So what's the name of this place?
This is, they call it the Caches, and it's just was the, I don't know what the Indian name for it would have been, but it's, everybody calls it the Caches now. Mm-hmm.
Did you come and, here with your dad?
Yeah, I used to come when I was a kid to that graveyard camp we flew over just above here, and they had a big camp there, and we'd come over in the spring.
Yeah?
And,
got one good.
Oh boy, yeah. That's a good one.
Oh wow, you did, yeah. Did you measure it? I think I have a tape, yeah?
But
Yeah, we'd come over by dog team, and then see, it was a long ways by boat then, because you had to go all the way down the Tanana and up what they call Swan Neck Slough, and then up to Tolovana and up to Chattanooga, and to get in here was about about 80 miles by water, and it's only 15 miles straight across. And so, and there's portages that they used to portage across in the spring and in the fall with canoes. And they had to make about 4 or 5 portages and into different lakes and sloughs to get over here.
So, did they ever come with their dog teams?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd come like in the spring when they'd move out of Minto before breakup and come over here with their dog team. And then after breakup, they used to go out of here. A lot of times they'd go out by raft and the dogs would run along the bank. And then later they had boats. Well, they went out by boat, or, most people didn't have one, but somebody that had a boat would hire, people to hire them to take them back around to the village and all their stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, but they always moved out like in about March and started trapping muskrats, and they were here for spring breakup, where there was, they catch a lot of fish in here. They have like that little tripod over there. Mm-hmm. They set that right alongside of the bank and they use it to hold their dip nets. And they dip the fish out of the slough. And then they had some set nets down here around the corner now. But see, like I said before, they had the weir, and then they just dip the fish out of it.
Well, see,
no, they hold it because the dip net's heavy to hold in the current, so they just use that to rest the handle on and just hold the end of it. See? So they didn't have to hold the whole net up, the whole dip net up. And they still do that. There were some people here this spring from Minto that stayed. I flew them out here before breakup, and they stayed through breakup, and they catch a lot of fish and hunt in the spring. Yeah. Yeah, them and Evelyn and Jim Alexander, and they brought some of their kids and grandkids out. But this is really an old place. Nobody really knows how old it goes back to. Like Peter John told me that they had that big camp right here. But see, there was other camps scattered all over, one called Birch Hill and the Graveyard Camp and Gather Up Camp. That's right up here.
I wasn't getting fresh. Thank you.
Well, Jeannie was saying something about being interested in restoring these.
Well, see, somebody's got a deal going where they have these historical sites, and they're trying to make a historical site out of that, and then I'll get somebody to come in and fix those old caches up so they don't all crash down. They've been, every year another one falls down. That used to be a solid line of caches over there. And now there's only, 7 of them left. But there was probably about 15 or 20 over there originally. And I came in here because, it was a good place to. This always opens up first in the spring, the water does here. Before any place else in the flats opens up, this slough opens up. So, it's a good place to land. And I filed an allotment on this. I have 5 acres in this chunk here. And built these cabins just to, take fishermen out. And I used it for, to fill in on my airplane business is the reason it got started in the first place, because I was having a hard time getting, business. So I just built one little cabin and started bringing people out. And then I built another one. And then everybody said, well, why don't you build more? And I said, no, I can't. See, this country can't stand too much. And if I built a big camp, it'd be ruined overnight. So I just, bring in whatever 2 cabins will hold, just a few parties, and try to keep things down, You going on a trip or what?
I'm going to send you up the river.
He's going to take a picture of your cabins.
He wants to get a picture from across the...
So you were saying a few days ago that people that you bring out, mostly it's Fairbanks people?
No, it's people from all over. We bring them out from Fairbanks, but they come from all over the country. You know, people that come up for vacations from the States come out here and spend a couple of days, or a lot of people from Fairbanks come out here and spend a couple of days. And see, we furnish the boats and motors and gas and cabins and everything, you know, so they don't have to bring any camping gear. It's another reason I started. I'd haul fishermen out someplace and they'd have so much gear you couldn't get them in one load, you know, two or three people, and they bring all their rubber boat and their camping gear and everything. There's no way you can get it in the airplane. So I figured this way all they have to do is bring their groceries and their fishing gear, and you got everything set up for them. And you don't have to, you know, you can, I'll take more people in a trip, so it holds the price down.